take whatever posture you want for this, but if you want to stand, be like Kevin. That's always good. Be like Kevin. And if you feel like you got to sit down, that's fine. Just be comfortable, all right? Because we'll be reading John 9, 1 through 41. As Jesus walked along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. We must work the works of the one who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. And as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud on the man's eyes, saying to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. Then he went and washed and came back able to see. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar began to ask, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some were saying, "It is he." Others were saying, "No, but it's someone like him." He kept saying, I am the he. Yeah, but they kept asking him. "Then how were his eyes opened?" he answered. "The man called Jesus made mud, spread it on my eyes, and said to him, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' Then I went and washed and received my sight." And they said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." Then they brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also began to ask him how he received his sight. He said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, then I washed, and now I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not observe the Sabbath." Others said, "How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?" And they were divided. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him?" It was your eyes he opened." And he said, "He is a prophet." The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does now he see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son, and that he was born blind, but we do not know how it is that now he sees, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he's of age, he'll speak for himself." Well, his parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So, for the second time, they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." And he answered, "I do not know whether he is a sinner. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." And they said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" Well, he answered them, "I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" Then they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." The man answered, "Here is an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but God does listen to one who worships God and obeys God's will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "Well, you were born entirely in sins, and are you trying to teach us?" And they drove him out. Well, Jesus heard that they had driven him out, and when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" Well, he answered, "And who is he, sir? Tell me so that I may believe in him." Well, Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see, and those who do see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees who were with him heard this, and they said to him, "Surely we are not blind, are we?" And Jesus said to them, "Well, if you were blind, you would not have sin. But now that you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." The word of the Lord. Please.
So last week when Pete got done reading, Cohen turned to me and said, "How many slides was that?" Because it was like verses 5 through 42. So I went back and counted. 13 last week. This week, 14 slides. Shannon set the record. At least we had a radio voice reading it, right? Like of all voices, thank you, Shannon, for reading that for us this week. Oh. The Pharisees answered the man, "You were born entirely in your sins." And they drove him out. So, here's something that seems so obvious, it's hardly worth mentioning, but I'll go ahead and mention it anyway. 3 years ago, almost to the day, in fact, Bill, our beloved Bill, came forward and shared with us some extraordinarily good news. His doctors, he reported, had recently informed him that the tumors they had been monitoring were currently undetectable. And although they were not able to tell him what this meant for him long term, what they were able to say was, "Bill, go and live your life." And hearing that news, after praying alongside him and Julie, after hearing him share his journey with cancer, and of course, after loving his family as we do, when we heard him share that news, we could not help ourselves. If you recall, we rose spontaneously and applauded, and we rejoiced, and we cried, and we laughed, and we showered love, and why wouldn't we? Because honestly, what else would you do in a moment like that, right? A little over a decade ago, on a midweek evening, a group of East County members gathered right here in this very auditorium. I believe it was Leland Howe who pulled everyone together that night. Many here today showed up that evening. We sat in this really big circle facing one another and spent 2 hours offering prayers in solidarity with the Langford family, a family who had lived among us as members, who were married among us as a couple, who were sent out from us as missionaries to Uganda, a family we love, and a family who had recently been informed that their youngest child, their daughter Bella, had been diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. It was a grueling and emotional and painful and honestly healing evening all mixed together in one. And after that moment ends all the moments of worry and hope and concern that followed that time. When we heard from the Langfords and from their doctors that Bella was healed, that her treatment was successful, this congregation erupted in praise and thanksgiving and gratefulness and joy. We wept and we laughed and we rejoiced at the extraordinary goodness of it all, because honestly, what else would you do in a moment like that, right? And if I were to ask, does any of that surprise you? The fact that when we heard the news about Bill and about Bella, we rejoiced, that we were filled with gladness and wonder and delight? Would that surprise you? I'm guessing you would say, no. No, it didn't surprise us that we rejoiced. Not any more than 29 years ago, again, nearly to the day, on St. Patrick's Day, 1997. A group of East County women and men, again, many of whom are right here in this room, stood alongside our beloved Nancy and prayed over her and anointed her and grieved with her and yearned for Nancy's healing from chronic pain. And when, in what Nancy to this day refers to as a miracle, her doctors declared, while we can't tell you why, what we can tell you is that your illness has disappeared, East County erupted in celebration. Like it was 1999, if you know what I mean. Because honestly, what else would you do in a moment like that, right? Good news deserves good celebration, which is just what we offered. Now, again, all of that is so abundantly obvious, it's hardly worth even mentioning. Of course that's what we do. So why then have I gone ahead and mentioned all that anyway today? Well, because of this. John 9, our gospel passage this morning. For I'm hopeful that by keeping Bill and Bella and Nancy in mind today, and in particular, our responses to their healing, that we'll be able to hear the wisdom at the heart of John's words. Put differently, I hope that by keeping Bill and Bella and Nancy in mind this morning, we just might hear how extraordinarily strange John 9 really is. Let me ask you this. Have you ever told what you presumed was a really interesting and entertaining and amazing story, only to get to the punchline and have your audience say, and? As if what you've just shared didn't quite land the way you imagined it would. I wonder, does your audience ever do that to you? Well, if so, you're in a perfect position to understand exactly what is so startling about John 9. You see, when commentators reflect on this passage, nearly all of them focus on, say, the legalism of the Pharisees that day, or the clever use of light and darkness in the passage, or even the oddness of Jesus making a paste of mud with his own spit, which admittedly is quite odd. Or they suggest that that pericope is meant to be a sign of Jesus' messiahship. And while all of that's good, none of that's wrong, it seems to me that not one bit of what those commentaries are focusing on actually gets to the most important point, as if the entire punchline of the passage has been passed over completely. Let me put it this way. When it comes to our beloved East County members, you can easily imagine how utterly unfathomable it would have been had Bill made his announcement and our collective response was to simply look at our watches and wonder when we could leave for lunch. How unimaginable it would have been had we heard the news about Bella and yawned. How unthinkable it would have been had Nancy's doctors offered their report and we simply shrugged. It would have been inconceivable, as the infamous Vicini might say. Our joyful response to their good news is so utterly obvious to us. It just comes naturally. And yet, that is just the thing about John 9 that is so peculiar. For that very same utterly obvious response to healing is precisely what is entirely absent in the story of the man blind from birth. In John's lengthy narrative, I wonder, did you notice this? Not a single person, not one, rejoices when the blind man is healed. Nobody, not even the man's parents, express joy or wonder or gratitude or awe. Not a single person ever once says to that man, "I'm so happy for you," or asks, "What is it like to see for the very first time? Does the sunlight hurt your eyes? Or what would you like to see first?" In other words, no one in the entire 41 verses stands and applauds the unbelievably good news of this healing. And I find that, frankly, inconceivable. Just to the extent that I cannot imagine Bill sharing his report without the exultant ovation that followed it, I can't fathom why nothing of the sort occurs here in John 9. The man was blind and now he sees. His tumors are now undetectable. His illness has been eliminated. Her chronic pain is cured. For the first time in his life, this man can smile at someone and see their smile in return. So where is all the whooping and rejoicing that's supposed to follow? Because honestly, what else do you do in a moment like that, right? Only here's the issue. I wonder, have you ever seen that film, Ford versus Ferrari, race car movie? There's this moment in that movie when one of the race car drivers, the person we've been rooting for the whole time, is so far ahead that he could coast to a first place finish. But his team asks him to slow down so that all three Fords in the race can finish at the same time, tied for first. And so he does. And because of a technicality in the rules about who started the farthest back, the trophy actually goes not to that man you've been rooting for, but to one of his teammates you don't care all that much for at all. And in that moment, the audience is left stunned and silent, because the one who just received the award simply did not deserve it. And everybody knew it. And nothing offends our sensibilities, our sense of justice, more than undeserved reward. And that, it seems to me, is precisely what's at play in John 9. No one rejoices with that healed man because no one believes he deserves his reward. Not his neighbors, not the disciples, and quite possibly not even his parents. Such that when the Pharisees speak their cruel words, they are merely voicing what everyone else is thinking. "You," they say to him, "are a sinner." In other words, "you don't deserve this." And instead of rejoicing, they drive him out. You see, the one significant difference between Bill, Bella, and Nancy and the man blind from birth is this. We do not believe that Bill, Bella, and Nancy deserve to suffer, such that when they receive relief, it affirms our sense of justice in this world. And so we rightly rejoice. But it was not so for the man born blind. It was, they say, on account of his own sins that he suffers as he does. Even the disciples said that. It was account of his own sins that he suffers as he does. They don't rejoice in his healing because they don't believe he deserves the trophy in the first place. That should be reserved for the likes of Bill and Bella and Nancy. And now, lest we chalk all this up to those silly first century folks and their immature beliefs, let us recall that we often say and think the very same thing. His homelessness is his own fault. Her addiction is her own responsibility. Their never-ending grief, that's their own issue. We say, I'm not opposed to helping people. I just don't want it wasted on those who don't deserve it. And the Pharisees said to him, you are a sinner. And they drove him out. And just here, it seems to me, is John's powerful punchline. Although everyone else in this entire scene has asked about the man's sin instead of rejoicing in his healing, Jesus is having none of it. His help will not be based on a calculation of who deserves it most. In fact, he scraps that sort of calculation altogether. Because for Jesus, the question is not who deserves help, but rather the question is who's going to be finally willing to actually offer it. And that stance, it seems to me, changes everything. Because for Jesus, the issue is never whether we've earned the grace we've received. As Paul says, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Which is to say, for Jesus, care and kindness do not begin with a question about them, but rather a question about us. Will we serve one another in whatever ways we can, regardless of our opinion of the other person's faults and sins? For the Pharisees, of course, such behavior is scandalous. But for Jesus, it's precisely the sort of behavior that defines what it means to be an instrument of peace in the first place. Why does no one rejoice when the man born blind is healed? Because, as Jesus says, they're all blind themselves. Blind to the fact that God doesn't offer grace because we deserve it. Which is not to say, of course, we don't deserve it. It's just to say that that's not part of God's calculation at all. Rather, God offers us grace so that we might offer it in return. Freely, profligately, wildly, and scandalously. Just like Jesus does. Amen.